Welcome in. I'm so incredibly thrilled that you are joining us today, you specifically.
Yeah, we're really glad you're here for this one.
Because today we are embarking on a mission that requires a genuinely curious, open mind. We're going to explore a white paper that is, quite frankly, profound.
It really is. It shifts the ground right under your feet.
Exactly. It has the potential to completely alter how you view the world around you, your daily routine, and even the stress you feel when you check your bank account. The paper is titled Money, Scarcity, and Violence: Monetary Architecture, Institutional Design, and the Conditions of Civilizational Viability.
Quite a mouthful of a title.
It is. And it was co-authored by Dr. Pechora Sekeli and ChatGPT from OpenAI.
So, okay, let's unpack this because the core paradox this paper presents is something you see every single day, even if you haven't fully consciously processed it yet.
Right, it's hidden in plain sight.
Just picture this for a second. We live in a civilization with absolutely unprecedented productive capacity. I mean, we have the technology to grow food at a massive global scale. We can build advanced earthquake-resistant infrastructure.
Yeah, and we coordinate incredibly complex global supply chains in real time using digital systems that basically border on magic at this point.
But
But
this.
then, look out the window. If you walk down the street in almost any major metropolitan area on Earth, you see severe housing shortages and skyrocketing homelessness existing right alongside, literally right next door to gleaming, vacant luxury units.
We see food insecurity right alongside staggering agricultural abundance, where excess crops are sometimes just literally left to rot in the fields.
And untreated illnesses operating in the direct shadow of the most advanced medical systems in human history. It's maddening.
What's fascinating here is that public discourse almost always treats these contradictions as moral failures.
Oh, absolutely.
Watch the news, and we see politicians blaming individual incompetence, or they blame administrative inefficiency, or they just wave their hands vaguely and blame mysterious market forces.
Like the economy is just the weather, like a thunderstorm that rolled in.
Exactly. But the mission of our deep dive today is to step entirely away from that kind of moralizing. We aren't looking for villains here. We aren't here to point fingers at specific politicians or specific billionaires.
Right.
We are looking at the structural architecture of our money itself. We're going to explore what the authors call the scarcity gate hypothesis. The goal today is to help you distinguish between real physical limits, the actual tangible boundaries of our material world, and the institutional rules we've simply invented.
Which is such a vital distinction.
Right.
We need to figure out when money is acting as a neutral tool for coordinating resources
Yeah.
and when it transforms into an active, aggressive gatekeeper to human survival.
And that visual you mentioned before we started, the cover art.
Oh man, yeah. I think the cover art of this white paper perfectly captures that exact tension. It shows this beautifully detailed globe, but it's wrapped in these massive, heavy iron chains.
It's a very striking image.
And balancing on the surface of this chained globe, you see houses, pristine nature, and stacks of gold coins. It is such a visceral visualization of the tension between our ecological, physical reality and the monetary constraints we build over top of it.
It really makes you realize that maybe the chains holding us back are made of steel. Maybe they're made of rules.
Yes, rules.
Okay.
The paper makes a brilliant move right out of the gate by shifting how we view economic crises. Normally, when you watch the news, you hear about an inflation spike, or a sudden debt crisis, or a harsh austerity program, and it's reported as an event.
Like a natural disaster.
Exactly, like a storm that just blew in. But this text argues that these aren't isolated events or temporary glitches in the matrix. They are features of a permanent architecture. So what does this all mean? How does this scarcity gate hypothesis actually work in practice?
Well, it means we have to radically redefine what we mean by the word scarcity. We need to clearly separate physical scarcity from structural scarcity.
Okay, lay that out for us.
Physical scarcity is undeniable. It is scientific and it is very real. If there is a massive multi-year drought in the Midwest and the wheat crops die, there is a physical scarcity of food.
Right, the food literally does not exist.
Exactly. No amount of money, no central bank policy, and no political speech can instantly make that grain exist. That is a hard physical, biophysical limit.
Physics always wins.
Always. But structural scarcity is entirely different. Structural scarcity occurs when the physical capacity to meet human needs absolutely exists. The labor is standing by, the materials are sitting in warehouses, the technology is fully developed, but access to those resources is artificially restricted by the rules of the monetary system.
It's locked away.
Precisely. The scarcity gate hypothesis suggests that in many of our systems, money isn't just a convenient medium of exchange so you don't have to trade chickens for shoes.
Right.
It is a conditional gatekeeper to essential provisioning. If you don't have the specific token, the gate stays closed, even if the warehouse behind the gate is overflowing with exactly what you need to survive.
Let me stop you right there because that distinction is so critical, but I want to make sure we are really grounding it. Because confusing physical scarcity with structural scarcity seems to be exactly how we end up normalizing entirely preventable deprivation.
That's the danger. It becomes normalized.
The paper gives some stark examples of this, like healthcare. Think about a hospital with empty beds, idle MRI machines, and trained nurses who might be unemployed or underemployed. If a patient is denied care because they lack insurance or funds, that is not a physical scarcity of healthcare.
Not at all.
The physical capacity is sitting right there, plugged into the wall, ready to be used. Or think about energy poverty in regions that are incredibly energy abundant, where the infrastructure exists, the power plants are running, but people are shut off from the grid in the dead of winter because they can't pay the bill.
And this framework completely changes how you hear political rhetoric.
Yes. I feel like this happens all the time in political debates. You hear a politician on a debate stage say, "We simply can't afford to build new public housing."
And you have to ask, what does afford mean?
Right. Does that mean we literally lack the concrete, the steel, the lumber, and the construction workers? Or does it just mean we lack the invented monetary tokens under the current accounting rules we've agreed to play by?
Exactly. You are hitting on the fundamental illusion of modern economics. And to reiterate, identifying this is not indulging in some grand conspiracy theory.
Yeah, we have to be clear about that.
There is no secret smoky room of people rubbing their hands together plotting to keep people poor. It is a dispassionate system observation. When you see persistent deprivation amid aggregate physical capacity, it indicates the presence of a gating mechanism.
The system is just operating exactly as it was designed to operate.
The architecture is doing its job. Think of it like a massive digital paywall on a news website. The article is already written. It is sitting on the server. Delivering it to your screen costs essentially zero physical resources.
Just a few electrons.
Right. But if you don't input the credit card, the code blocks you. Our entire real-world economy operates on a similar, highly enforced paywall for survival.
But to truly understand how this architecture was built, we have to look back. We have to trace the evolutionary phases of money, because humans absolutely did not always live like this.
No, we didn't.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because when you say we didn't always live like this, it forces us to re-examine everything we assume is just human nature. The paper outlines the history of money as a gatekeeper, and it starts with what they call pre-monetary coordination.
Let's travel back in time a bit.
Yeah. Back in early human societies, survival wasn't based on how many tokens you had in your pocket. It was based on relational mechanisms. It was about reciprocity, reputation, and kinship networks.
If the tribe had a successful hunt or good harvest, you ate.
Your survival was based on your social inclusion in the group, your relationships, and your shared physical labor, not your possession of an abstract currency.
That's right. Access to subsistence was relationally mediated, not monetarily gated. You contributed to the group, and the group ensured your survival.
So what changed?
Scale. As populations grew and agricultural surpluses allowed for the rise of massive administrative states, think ancient Mesopotamia or early Egypt societies, faced a new complex problem. You couldn't just rely on knowing everyone in your village anymore.
Right, you can't have a personal relationship with 10,000 people.
Exactly. You had to track contributions across thousands of people. You had to organize massive labor pools to build irrigation canals. And crucially, you had to provision specialists like soldiers, priests, and artisans who weren't farming for themselves.
They needed to eat too.
Yes. This is where accounting emerges. We see the invention of clay tablets, tally sticks, and standardized units of measurement. In this early phase, money was primarily a unit of account.
So it wasn't coins yet?
No. It was a way to measure obligations and keep records, not necessarily a physical coin that you carried around in a leather pouch to buy your lunch.
Okay, so it was basically just a giant Excel spreadsheet made of clay. But that doesn't sound inherently violent or restrictive. It just sounds like good administration.
Yeah.
So when does the trap spring? When does this useful accounting tool turn into the gatekeeper of survival?
The massive turning point, the real hinge of economic history, is the invention of what the paper calls the behavioral lever, monetized taxation. Yes, the moment an authority, whether it's a king, an emperor, or a modern state, demands that you pay your taxes only in a very specific unit that they issue, everything changes.
Because suddenly you have to get your hands on that specific token.
Right. It doesn't matter if you have a barn full of wheat or a herd of fat cattle. If the king says the tax is payable only in his stamped silver coins, you have to find a way to get those coins. This creates an instant, systemic, society-wide demand for that unit.
I see. So it's not that people naturally loved silver coins. It's that the king held a sword to their head and said, give me this coin by April 15th or else.
That's the behavioral lever.
It is the ultimate behavioral lever. Because when obligations are non-optional, legally enforceable, and payable only in a designated unit, all economic activity completely reorganizes around acquiring that unit.
The issuing authority gains massive influence over how human labor is mobilized.
Stop farming just to feed your family. And you start doing whatever the guy with the coins wants you to do just so you can pay the tax.
Precisely. And this dynamic kicks off historical waves of scarcity institutionalization. The paper traces this brilliantly, showing how the trap closes tighter and tighter over centuries.
That's a progression.
It is. It starts with early agrarian tribute systems, where survival was still largely tied to the land, but authorities extracted a surplus. But the most devastating shift, the one that really built the modern world, occurs between the 15th and 19th centuries in Europe, particularly in England. This is the period of enclosure.
Oh, man, enclosure. I feel like this is the biggest, most important historical event that nobody ever learns about in school. Let's really dive into this because it is the missing puzzle piece for why we live the way we do today.
It absolutely is.
Before enclosure, for centuries, regular people, peasants, commoners, had independent access to what were called the common lands. You didn't own the land, but you had traditional rights to use it.
You could graze your sheep. You could forage for mushrooms. You could cut wood for your fire.
You could grow vegetables. You had direct, unmediated access to your own physical survival. If you didn't have a coin to your name, you wouldn't starve because the earth provided.
And that independence was a massive problem for the emerging capitalist class and the aristocracy.
Why is that a problem?
Because if people can feed themselves, they have no incentive to go work in a dangerous, dark factory for 14 hours a day for a pittance. So over several centuries, through a series of legal acts, the government literally fenced off those lands.
They enclosed them. Yeah.
They privatized the commons and handed them to wealthy landowners to raise sheep for the highly profitable wool trade. The result was catastrophic for the common people.
They lost everything.
They lost their independent access to subsistence. And when you can no longer feed yourself directly from the earth, what happens? You become entirely dependent on wage labor.
You have to migrate to the filthy, overcrowded cities.
You have to sell your time, your body, and your labor to a factory owner for money, just to buy the food you used to grow yourself.
It's just wild to think about. It was the forced creation of the working class. They didn't flock to the factories because of the wonders of industrialization. They were starved off their land and had no other choice. It progressively decoupled humans from direct subsistence.
And if you want to see how explicit and intentional this gating mechanism is, you only have to look at how this same mechanism was deployed globally through colonial monetary engineering in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Let's talk about that.
Let's take a specific example from colonial Africa. European colonial authorities would move into a region. They would find local populations who were often perfectly content, self-sufficient, and functioning entirely outside the European capitalist system.
They were just living their lives.
Right. But the colonial powers needed cheap labor to work in their diamond mines, gold mines, or on export-oriented cash crop plantations like rubber or cotton. But the local people had no desire to do backbreaking labor for foreign paper money they didn't need.
Right. If I have my own farm in my own community, why would I go dig a hole for you?
Exactly. So how do you force them? You introduce a hut tax or a poll tax. The colonial governor simply decrees that every household must pay a tax every year, explicitly and exclusively payable in the colonial currency, say, British shillings.
Wow.
Now, the local population is suddenly thrown into a crisis. They don't have shillings. The only way to get shillings is to go work in the colonial mines or on the plantations.
And if they refuse?
If they don't pay the tax, their cattle are confiscated, their huts are burned down, or they are thrown in prison.
That is just chilling. They deliberately manufactured scarcity. They used the tax code, not to raise revenue, but to literally force human beings out of self-sufficiency and into a terrifying, money-gated system of wage slavery.
It's a very dark history.
Contrast those two worlds for a second. Imagine being in a pre-monetary kinship network where a massive harvest means everyone celebrates, rests, and shares the bounty.
A physical abundance.
Yes. Now, contrast that with a colonial subject who has plenty of food growing in their village, but the men are forced to leave their families for months to do incredibly dangerous labor hundreds of miles away just to acquire a metal token to pay a tax so their home isn't destroyed. It completely shifts the entire purpose of human effort.
It does. The physical form of the token doesn't matter here, whether it's a paper note, a silver coin, or a digital blip on a screen. What matters is the enforceable obligation attached to it.
The threat of violence.
Yes. And the paper argues this evolutionary process continues right up into industrial capitalism and our modern global finance system. It evolves into complex credit hierarchies, where your access to money depends on what collateral you already own.
And on a macro level, whole nations in the global south are constrained by external debt obligations dictated by the IMF or the World Bank, forcing them to export their raw materials instead of feeding their own people.
It's the same mechanism, just scaled up.
Okay, so if the system is as structurally violent as you say, and we are trapped in this loop of paying to survive, how does this gatekeeping actually function today in our modern lives? We aren't paying a colonial hut tax, and we aren't being forced off the village commons by English lords.
The mechanisms are more sophisticated now.
Right. The paper breaks down the present day into section 3, introducing 4 interlocking structural systems that produce durable scarcity gating. Let's lay them out, because I think everyone listening will immediately recognize these forces in their own life.
Let's do it. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these 4 systems are the invisible architecture of your daily economic life. The first is the obligation system.
Dead rock.
This is the bedrock. Taxes, debts, fines, and recurring bills. These create a continuous, legally enforceable, unyielding demand for money. You have to pay your taxes. You have to pay your mortgage or your rent. You have to pay your student loans.
You have no choice. The clock is always ticking, resetting every 30 days.
And the second is the dispossession system. This builds directly on that history of enclosure we just talked about.
The modern version of fencing off the commons.
Exactly. This is the modern reduction of independent survival options. It's the intense commodification of housing. It's the privatization of water utilities. It's laws against foraging or living off grid.
It ensures that opting out of the money system is legally and practically impossible. You can't just go pitch a tent in the woods and live off the land. You'll be arrested for trespassing.
Money is not an optional tool for commerce. It is a strict, legally enforced requirement for staying alive.
Which brings us to the third pillar, the discipline system. Because your survival now strictly depends on monetary income, employment becomes an existential necessity.
And this system operates through the constant, low-grade threat of unemployment and the precarity of labor.
The fear of losing your job is a massive compliance mechanism. If you are terrified of losing your health care or your home, you will tolerate a lot.
You will tolerate bad managers, stagnant wages, unsafe working conditions, and long hours. Precarity is the stick that keeps labor disciplined.
And finally, the fourth pillar, which might be the most insidious, the rent system. Now, we aren't just talking about the rent you pay to a landlord, though that's part of it.
Right. In economic terms, economic rent refers to income derived strictly from ownership and control, not from producing anything new or adding value to society.
We are talking about interest payments to banks, monopoly pricing by massive corporations, and asset inflation. When the things we absolutely need to survive, like a basic roof over our heads, become financialized assets traded by hedge funds, the baseline cost of survival constantly, permanently rises.
And here is where the analytical power of the paper really shines, what they call system coupling dynamics.
How they all link together.
Yes, it's how these 4 pillars feed into each other to create a self-reinforcing loop that traps the average person. Let's walk through this plumbing together. Imagine 2 people walk into a bank.
Okay.
One is a brilliant engineer with a great idea for a new, highly efficient solar panel, and they need a loan to build a factory, hire workers, and create real value. The other person is an investor who just wants to buy a third house to rent out at a markup.
Under our current system, the bank is heavily incentivized to give the newly created money to the landlord, right? Why is that?
Because of how credit creation works. Banks don't just lend out existing deposits, they create new money when they issue a loan. But they need collateral to minimize their risk.
And the landlord has the existing house.
The landlord has an existing house to put up as collateral. The solar engineer only has a business plan. So the banking system mathematically favors pumping new money into existing assets, inflating the prices of housing. This is the rent system in action.
So let's follow that loop for a normal family. Because the rent system has artificially inflated housing costs, rent is exorbitant.
Right.
Because rent takes up 50% of their income, the family has to take on high-interest credit card debt just to buy groceries or fix their car. That increased debt intensifies their obligation pressures.
Now they are drowning in obligations.
And because they are drowning, they are absolutely terrified of losing their job, which reinforces the discipline system. They will accept stagnant wages. They won't unionize. They won't complain.
And because labor is thoroughly disciplined and wages are kept low across the economy, corporate profits stay high.
Which means those high profits sustain and inflate stock prices and real estate values, feeding right back into the rent system. It is a perfect vicious circle.
It is perfectly calibrated, which raises an important question. Does the system require everyone to be totally destitute and starving in the streets for it to function?
I would assume not. Otherwise, the system would collapse.
The paper argues no. It introduces the concept of managed vulnerability. The system doesn't need universal poverty. In fact, total poverty would mean nobody could buy the goods being produced.
Right.
It just needs vulnerability to be perfectly calibrated. It needs the average person to be just precarious enough to maintain labor discipline and preserve wealth concentration, but partially buffered by minimum wage laws, food stamps, and targeted social programs so that society doesn't collapse into total violent revolution.
Wait, hold on. I want to make sure I'm understanding the sheer mechanics of this.
Mm-hmm.
Are you telling me that people in nice suits sit in a room and actively decide that a certain number of people must be poor and desperate, that it's actually policy?
I am telling you to look at the historical actions of central banks. Let's look at how central banks, like the Federal Reserve, fight inflation. They operate on economic models like the Phillips curve or the concept of NRRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment.
The acronyms are always so sterile.
Very sterile. The fundamental belief in these orthodox models is that if unemployment gets too low, workers gain too much bargaining power. They demand higher wages. If wages rise, corporations raise prices to maintain their profit margins, which causes inflation.
So what is the central bank's prescribed cure for inflation?
They raise interest rates specifically to cool down the economy, make borrowing expensive, and force companies to lay off workers.
So the explicit goal is to increase unemployment. They actively want people to lose their jobs to fix a spreadsheet.
Yes. It is explicitly stated in their own minutes and reports. They use human insecurity and job loss as a macroeconomic stabilization tool. They are balancing the financial ledger on the backs of the most vulnerable workers. If the economy gets too hot, they throw human livelihoods onto the fire to cool it down.
That is heavy. I want you, listening right now, to stop and consider how these four pillars intersect in your own life.
Yeah.
Think about your monthly budget. Think about the stress you feel on a Sunday night before the work week begins.
It's a very real stress.
How much of your economic activity, your mental energy, your daily labor is driven purely by the obligation and rent systems? How much of your precious time on this earth is spent just keeping the gates of survival open for another 30 days?
It really changes your perspective.
It is a heavy realization, which naturally leads us to the enforcement layer. Because a system that requires this much continuous effort, this much extraction, and generates this much precarity doesn't just sustain itself by accident. It requires enforcement. But it enforces itself without looking like an obvious cartoonish dictatorship.
The paper categorizes this enforcement into three distinct forms of violence. The first is direct violence.
That's the physical force.
This is what we typically think of when we hear the word violent state force. It's the armed sheriff arriving to execute an eviction. It's foreclosures. It's the policing of informal survival strategies, like passing laws that criminalize sleeping in your car or giving food to the homeless in a public park.
It's making survival illegal.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In stable systems, direct violence is actually kept latent. It operates at the edges. Most people comply and pay their rent because they know, eventually, men with guns will arrive to remove them if they stop paying. So the direct violence doesn't need to be deployed constantly against the middle class. It acts as a boundary condition, a silent threat.
The second layer is structural violence. And this one is insidious because there is no visible aggressor. You can't point a camera at it easily. It's the harm caused simply by the institutional arrangements operating exactly as designed.
It's the silent killer.
It's the person who dies of an entirely treatable illness because they lost their job, lost their health insurance, and couldn't afford insulin. It's the family sleeping in a freezing car parked directly beneath a completely empty, speculative, luxury condo building. No single person decided to harm that specific family. There's no villain twirling a mustache pushing them into the cold. The rules of the monetary gate just operated normally. The bank maximized its shareholder value, and the result was preventable human suffering.
And to ensure that the general public accepts both the direct and the structural violence without revolting, you absolutely need the third layer, cultural
The
violence.
narratives.
These are the pervasive narratives, the myths that legitimize the system. It's the stories we tell ourselves constantly, that poverty is a result of personal failure or laziness, that billionaires are morally superior geniuses, that the free market is a perfectly neutral, almost divine arbiter of merit.
Or, most importantly, that scarcity is just a natural, unavoidable law of the universe.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, cultural violence internalizes the enforcement. If you fundamentally believe your deprivation is your own fault, you don't question the architecture. You just blame yourself and try to work harder.
Let's unpack the psychology of that, because the paper dives deep into the evolutionary and developmental dimensions of why we accept this, and I found this part fascinating.
It's a crucial piece of the puzzle.
Humans evolved in highly fluctuating, very dangerous environments over hundreds of thousands of years. We lived in small tribes. We are evolutionarily hardwired to be hypersensitive to resource insecurity and, crucially, social exclusion.
Being cast out of the tribe in the Paleolithic era meant almost certain death.
So what this modern scarcity-gated monetary system does is essentially hijack those ancient neural circuits.
It is a profound psychological hijack. When your survival is tied to a wage, any threat to that wage is processed by your brain, not as a minor inconvenience, but as a mortal threat.
Exactly. It's funny, you get a calendar invite from HR on a random Friday afternoon that just says quick sync, and your heart immediately starts pounding.
The panic sets in.
Your palms sweat. Your amygdala fires as if you were a caveman who just saw rustling in the bushes that might be a saber-toothed tiger. But it's just a Zoom link. Yet your body reacts because it knows that losing that job means losing the tokens required to keep a roof over your head. It feels like an absolute existential threat to your survival because structurally, it kind of is.
That evolutionary vulnerability is then compounded by a psychological phenomenon the paper calls cognitive conflation. From a very young age, we are conditioned to conflate institutional rules with physical limits. We merge them in our minds.
Give me an example of that.
When a government official steps to the podium, looks gravely into the camera, and says, "We simply cannot afford to build this clean water infrastructure for this struggling city," we immediately interpret that as the physical materials and the labor do not exist. We conflate the accounting device, the money, with the physical reality.
Right. If we want to build a high-speed rail network or a massive green energy grid, the physical reality is, do we have the steel? Do we have the copper? Do we have the lithium? Do we have the engineers who know how to design it and the millions of workers who know how to build it?
That's the real question.
If the answer is yes, then the project can physically exist in the real world. But the institutional reality might say, well, we've hit a purely invented debt ceiling, or the bond vigilantes demand austerity. So the workers sit at home unemployed, the steel sits in the foundry, and the green energy grid isn't built. The cultural narratives teach us from childhood that this is just how the economy works, that economic success equals moral competence. To critique the structure feels like attacking fairness itself.
But here's the hopeful part. Once we clearly recognize this cognitive conflation, we can begin to dismantle it. We can start asking the right questions. And that is exactly what the paper provides next, a diagnostic framework.
Okay, this is where we start fixing things.
If we are going to redesign this architecture, we have to be able to separate real physical limits from fake institutional ones. However, the authors are incredibly careful to warn against the risk of overcorrection.
Yes, let's talk about that, because the immediate counterargument is always, If money is just made up, let's just print $1 trillion and give everyone a mansion.
Right, and that would be a disaster. If we just assume all scarcity is a fake institutional rule, we will print endless amounts of money, spark hyperinflation, and completely destroy our ecological systems. We can't pretend physics doesn't exist. We need a rigorous, objective way to evaluate claims of affordability. The paper offers a brilliant three-step constraint diagnostic to do exactly this.
Okay, let's unpack this step by step, because this is a tool you can genuinely start using today when you read the news. Instead of just telling you how it works, let's apply it to a real-world scenario. Let's say a nation wants to completely overhaul its energy grid to 100% renewables.
Perfect example.
Step one is the real resource test. You ask, are the labor, the materials, the technology, and the logistical capacity actually available in the physical world? Do we have enough lithium, copper, silicon, and trained electricians?
And if the answer is no?
If the answer is no, if there literally isn't enough copper in the Earth's crust to build what we want, then you have a real physical constraint. Printing more money won't magically manifest copper out of thin air. But let's say we do have the resources and the idle labor. We proceed to step two.
Step two is the ecological ceiling test. You ask, would scaling this activity exceed environmental limits or degrade critical biophysical systems? Would mining that copper destroy a vital aquifer? Would the manufacturing process push carbon emissions past a planetary tipping point?
So this is about the planet's boundaries.
Yes. If the answer is yes, then you have a hard ecological constraint. The laws of physics, biology, and thermodynamics do not care about your monetary policy or your political goals. You cannot negotiate with the climate. But let's say the project is designed sustainably and does not violate ecological boundaries. You proceed to step three.
Step three is the institutional rule test. You ask, is the barrier stopping us merely a budget rule, a political debt limit, a balanced budget amendment, or a fear of downgrades by credit rating agencies? If you pass step one and step two, and the answer to step three is yes, then congratulations, you have identified an institutional constraint. It is a rule made up by humans, written on paper, and rules made up by humans can be changed by humans.
Let's apply this diagnostic to something more intimate, like healthcare provision. If you have trained medical personnel who are unemployed or underemployed, and the hospital facilities exist with empty beds, but care is being denied to a community due to a lack of state funding, that completely fails the real resource test for physical scarcity.
The beds are there, the doctors are there.
The physical limit hasn't been reached. The limit is entirely institutional. The money is acting as a violent gatekeeper.
The next time you are listening to a political debate or reading an article about a crisis and someone uses the word affordable, run it through that diagnostic. Are they talking about a lack of concrete and labor? Are they talking about a lack of atmospheric capacity for carbon? Or are they just talking about a lack of tokens on a spreadsheet?
It completely changes how you consume information.
And once you can see the matrix, you can start talking about how to rewrite the code. Which brings us to the solutions. The viability architecture. How do we actually redesign money so it acts as a public coordination utility instead of a weaponized scarcity gate?
The paper outlines four foundational design principles for this new architecture. Principle one is perhaps the most profound and the most controversial, the provisioning floor.
The provisioning floor.
This means securing non-negotiable universal access to the absolute basic necessities of life. We're talking about potable water, primary health care, basic nutrition, secure shelter, and baseline energy access. Notice, this is not about providing universal luxury. You don't get a free sports car.
Right.
It is about establishing a strict, unconditional baseline that completely removes the existential terror of absolute deprivation from the economy. It de-weaponizes survival.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic here, because the immediate argument you're going to hear is who is paying for that? If people get a house, food, and health care unconditionally, why would anyone ever show up to work? Who is going to clean the sewers, harvest the crops, or build the roads? Doesn't this just incentivize mass laziness?
That is the standard cultural narrative, but it fundamentally misunderstands what human beings are. The question who pays for it is exactly the cognitive conflation we just discussed. The real question is, do we have the physical capacity to provide a basic floor?
And the answer is yes.
The answer is overwhelmingly yes. As for laziness, empirical studies on universal basic income and guaranteed housing show the exact opposite. When people are freed from the chronic, exhausting stress of imminent homelessness, they actually engage more in society. They start small businesses, they care for sick relatives, they pursue education.
That makes sense. Survival mode is exhausting.
We currently use the threat of starvation to force people to clean sewers for poverty wages. If we remove that threat, it doesn't mean sewers won't get cleaned. It means society will have to pay the sewer cleaner a dignified, attractive wage that reflects the actual vital importance of the job, or we will have to automate it. It forces the market to value essential labor properly.
That is a massive paradigm shift. It forces the economy to serve society instead of society serving the economy. Principle 2 builds on this: employment is stabilization. Right now, as we discussed earlier, central banks use unemployment as a buffer to control inflation. They put people out of work to cool things down. This new architecture proposes replacing that cruelty with an employment guarantee.
Yes. Imagine standing public works programs, ecological restoration initiatives, care sector jobs, and community arts programs that automatically expand when the private sector contracts.
So there's always a backup.
If a recession hits and a private factory closes, those workers don't fall into destitution. They smoothly transition into the public employment guarantee, doing socially and ecologically useful work at a living wage. Instead of a buffer of unemployed, desperate people used to discipline wages, you have a buffer of employed people maintaining their dignity and contributing to their communities. It anchors the economy.
Principle 3 tackles the rent system we talked about earlier, credit allocation reform. In our current setup, banks create money primarily by lending against existing assets, fueling massive housing bubbles. A viable architecture actively directs credit creation toward expanding actual productive capacity.
Exactly. This requires public banking and credit guidance. Instead of commercial banks deciding what gets funded based purely on maximum short-term profit, public institutions guide credit toward building new, sustainable, affordable housing, funding massive renewable energy infrastructure, and supporting real technological innovation.
You starve the speculative asset bubbles and feed the real physical economy.
And Principle 4 brings the physical reality back into the math ecological integration. You bind the monetary authority strictly to biophysical limits. You incorporate carbon pricing, resource caps, and biodiversity mandates directly into how money is issued and tracked. You don't just balance the financial ledger, you balance the ecological ledger.
I love that, balancing the ecological ledger.
I want to highlight a crucial nuance here that the authors emphasize because people often hear this and think Soviet communism. This framework does not eliminate
That's a
markets.
huge point.
Let me repeat that clearly, it does not eliminate markets. Markets continue to operate, but they operate above the provisioning floor. You still have competition, you still have innovation, you still have private enterprise allocating non-essential goods and services.
So capitalism still exists for the fun stuff.
If you want to build a better smartphone, or design a sleek new electric car, or open a fantastic high-end restaurant, the market is perfectly suited for that. What this architecture does is stop using human survival as a disciplinary stick to subsidize cheap labor. It proves that achieving macroeconomic stability does not require chronic precarity and human sacrifice.
That is such a vital point. We aren't talking about ending commerce or banning entrepreneurship. We're talking about ending the threat of starvation as an economic tool. But of course, you can't just flip a switch overnight and change the entire global financial architecture. If you try to do that, things will violently break. The paper dedicates significant time to the transition pathways and the highly realistic risks of trying to reform this system. How do we get from here to there without crashing the airplane while we're rebuilding it in midair?
The authors propose a sequenced, phased approach. You don't start with a total systemic overhaul on day one. Phase one is to simply de-weaponize the essentials using existing laws.
So, using the tools we already have.
Yes. You aggressively strengthen eviction protections. You expand primary healthcare access. You ensure energy lifeline tiers where basic electricity cannot be shut off. You stabilize the floor using the institutions we already have.
And then.
Once that baseline vulnerability is reduced, you move to phase two, replacing the discipline mechanisms by piloting those employment guarantees at local and state levels.
Starting small to prove it works.
Only after that stability is proven and trusted do you move to phase three, which is the heavier lifting of reorienting credit and rent structures through public banking. And finally, phase four embeds the deep systemic ecological accounting at the central bank level.
And the paper doesn't shy away from the massive risks involved here. The authors are very clear-eyed about the dangers of getting this wrong. We talked about the risk of overcorrection earlier. If a government misunderstands this framework and thinks, oh, money is just an illusion, we can print whatever we want to fund all our pet projects, and their spending wildly exceeds the actual physical productive capacity of their workforce and materials, you will absolutely get crippling inflation.
the physical reality will reassert itself.
We've seen historical examples of nations printing money while ignoring the physical collapse of their agricultural or industrial sectors, and it always leads to hyperinflation and misery.
That is why the paper insists on constraint realism and gradualism. It cannot be economic shock therapy. Shock therapy destroys institutions and creates the exact kind of chaos and instability that makes people crave the old, violent, predictable system just to make the chaos stop.
Are there other risks for nations that aren't global superpowers?
Definitely. There are external currency constraints. If a nation in the global south doesn't have full monetary sovereignty, if they rely heavily on importing basic food and energy using foreign currency like U.S. dollars, they face incredible risks in transitioning. If they try to implement this locally, their currency might collapse on international markets. This requires international coordination, not just local policy.
Plus, the political resistance will be absolutely fierce. The people and institutions benefiting from entrenched rent interests, asset inflation, and disciplined cheap labor are not going to let go of their leverage quietly. They will use their massive cultural and media influence to convince the public that these reforms will destroy the country. Institutional inertia is a powerful force.
Which brings up the ultimate human element required for this transition, social trust.
Social trust.
If everyday people think these reforms are going to threaten their hard-earned pensions or cause the price of groceries to hyperinflate, they will fight the reforms tooth and nail. They will vote against their own long-term interests out of short-term fear. Transparency is the only antidote to that fear.
How do you build that transparency?
The paper suggests publishing a public constraint dashboard, a completely transparent, easily readable look at the nation's idle labor, capacity utilization, and ecological limits. If the public can clearly see the data, if they can see that we have the steel, the workers, and the ecological space, they can trust the process of issuing the money to mobilize them.
Which leads us to the synthesis of this entire deep dive. The paper presents this entire framework as nothing less than a civilizational choice. We're looking at the long-term viability of our societies. When survival access is monetarily conditional, when everyone is fighting for musical chairs just to survive, you generate massive internal stress, political polarization, scapegoating, and identity-based conflicts. The system stabilizes itself through managed insecurity, but it fractures the social fabric.
It's a choice between two paths.
The alternative is an architecture that secures survival within strict ecological limits, reducing that brutal enforcement pressure and strengthening true institutional legitimacy.
We have the physical capacity. The technological marvels of the 21st century have solved the problem of absolute physical scarcity for basic needs. The question now is whether we have the institutional courage and the collective imagination to align our rules with our physical reality.
Exactly. To sum up the main takeaways for you, money is not a law of physics. It is not gravity. It is a designed social technology. The scarcity you see around you in the midst of staggering technological abundance is not always a law of nature, very often. It is a deliberate policy choice embedded in the architecture. And choices, no matter how deeply entrenched, can be changed.
They absolutely can.
I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day or as you head into work tomorrow. Building on everything we've just unpacked, imagine if we actually succeeded. Just visualize it. If we successfully implemented a true provisioning floor globally, if the deep evolutionary existential terror of losing your shelter, your healthcare, or your ability to feed your family was completely permanently removed from the equation of your daily life.
It's a beautiful thought.
How would human ambition change? Would we see a decline in productivity and a slide into laziness, as the old economic models absolutely insist we would? Or would we unleash a renaissance of untapped human creativity, risk-taking, and innovation? How many brilliant artists, engineers, and scientists are currently trapped working mindless administrative jobs or grinding in the gig economy just to pay rent? What could they build, what could they discover, if they were no longer chained to the necessity of acquiring tokens just to survive? Thank you so much for taking this journey with us today. It's a heavy, complex topic, but ultimately it is an incredibly hopeful one. Keep questioning the architecture around you, keep looking past the paywalls, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.